so we can do line number two, which is August 1968. And this is an interesting layout. It is 34 white sheets, white pages, with not too much on each page. Very skimpy what's on each page. These are statements. So McLuhan would say, we're highlighting, we're like making 10 commandments. Each page has a commandment on it, so you'll look at it and react to it. So that's what I'm going to do. And then we got to bring, then we'll look at the notes. So are you guys ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can interrupt as we go along. Isn't that the way we do it? I don't mute, right? I just say it, and
yes,
you try to be
time.
Quiet. And then you say something, if something comes up. So we heard the one last week, 2 weeks ago, was all about events in the Global Theater. So this one's titled, When You Call Me That, Smile, unquote. So the headline is, When You Call Me That, Smile. So I guess people are yelling, it's been a hot summer, 1968, a lot of riots, assassinations, and McLuhan's addressing it by saying, When You Call Me That, Smile. So you can say all the crap you want, just as long as you smile. That would be, what, TV? Photogenic? There's a quote underneath it from The Virginian, which was like one of the first novels or books or stories about cowboys by Owen Wister. And so this idea of threatening, the quote is, it's not the brave man that's dangerous, it's the coward that scares me. It's not the brave man that's dangerous, it's the coward that scares me, says the Virginian. The coward maybe doesn't smile. When you call me that, smile. Then I know you're aware of your violence. If you're not smiling, you could be a problem. You're a robot. So, and I didn't know what's on the next page. So I'm saying there's something about violence here. So you turn to page two, there's only four words on page two. It says, this month's subject, hyphen, violence. So I picked that up. So this month's subject is violence. And this is appropriate because the summer of 68 was shocking Americans with all the violence for them, for that quiet world compared to now. It was really upsetting. Vietnam was heating up, all kinds of violent images coming out of the, because the satellite broadcast came in 1968. You could actually, as McLuhan says, there's no more news. You just go to where the action is, wherever the cameras take you. And the satellite broadcasting allowed you to go there, pretty well have a live broadcast. So people are being flung all over the globe through their TV. And a lot of it is violent scenes. So Americans are freaking. And they're going to decide there's too much chaos, and they're going to vote Nixon in. That's how Nixon becomes president, because of the effect of the satellite of 1968. Satellite broadcasting. So, when you call me that, smile. It's not the brave man that's dangerous, it's the coward that scares me. This month's subject, violence. That's page two. Page three, one line. Violence, underlined. Violence is the effort to maintain or restore a weakened psyche. A weakened psyche is like being a coward, right? When you're a coward, you're feeling weak. Violence is the effort to maintain a weakened psyche or restore a weakened psyche. There's no foundation for the weakened psyche anymore. Wiki psyche. For the weakened psyche, there's no props. It's weak. Thinking. Page four, one line. Violence is a quest for identity. - who am I? So here's this big executive newsletter which had a lot of words. When we read the last one, the first one, so far it's got hardly anything, blank pages. Violence is underlined. Violence is a quest for identity. And then down a little bit, it has a bunch of hyphens. Then it says, who am I? That's page four. And it says page five. Violence, underlined, is a norm on any frontier. Frontier is underlined. So when you're on the frontier, the only way, since you don't really have a stable environment like a town to preserve your identity, you always have to forge a new identity or retrieve an identity. So you're in a world of violence on the frontier. And McLuhan's saying the global theater is one where frontiers and boundary lines are bouncing up against everybody inside the live broadcasting. So the whole world is on the frontier of an interior tactile space. McLuhan, Ion defines tactility as contrast. That's a perfect definition of tactility. It's rubbing up against abrasive surfaces, interpenetrating and bumping into things. You're in the middle of a crowd. So, page 5, violence is a norm on any frontier, with violence and frontier underlined. Then dash, dash, why? There's Roxy's word, why? Okay, why is violence a norm on the frontier? Because on the frontier, men have forgotten or left behind their old identities. Okay, there's no area to reinforce your old identity. So violence is a norm because on the frontier, men have forgotten or left behind their old identities. So now we come to page 6, another one-liner, basically an empty page. It says, a frontier is not a neighborhood. It is a gap, a ferment, and interface. Gap, ferment, and interface define tactility. See, McLuhan never said that tactility was contrast. He did say it was abrupt interface. But Ion nails it with a word that nobody else used in relation to tactility, contrast. A frontier is not a neighborhood. You know, it's not an established reference point. It is a gap, a ferment, an interface. So frontier is not a geographical frontier, not necessarily the Wild West. It is you on the phone, listening to radio, in the discarnate, disembodied, angelic, superangelic space. That's where the frontier is. That's where the primitive lives.
Oh, what about ferment?
Well, that's the interaction of many people, different crowds on your TV screen. Different channels. Different stations. There's the ferment. And the screen is your face and your guts. So you are in the interface. So you're in a turmoil of violence, of upset constantly. And everybody just thought they're buying a little TV to watch a bunch of funny comedians or something. They didn't know it was going to disrupt their psyche beyond anything even worse than the atomic bomb. That was page 6. Page 7. Every new technology creates new frontiers, new environments. And then there's an asterisk beside environments, and both frontiers and environments are underlined. Then you look down at the asterisk, and it says, the Greek for environment is perivallo, P-E-R-I-V-A-L-L-O. It means to hit from all sides at once. In acoustic space and tactile space, you're being hit from all sides at once, especially when there's satellite broadcasting. We hear in one of the Tony Schwartz recordings him reporting that just the other day he was told the meaning of environment in Greek was perivallo. That's on the recording. So I heard the other day, guess what the Greek word for environment is? It's perivallo. It means to hit from all sides at once. You hear McLuhan saying that in one of those early tapes. So that's page 7. Page 8, a new environment is an attack on our senses and on our sense of ourselves. Dash, it numbs perception. An environment is underlined. A new environment, underlined, is an attack on our senses and on our sense of ourselves. It numbs perception. Now, what if everybody had that awareness in 1991, or let's say 1993, when Netscape brought forth their HTML and everybody could start easily using their computers? And everybody go, wait a minute, this is an attack on my sense of my sensory apparatus and myself. It's going to numb my perception. Now, pre-literate peoples had that awareness, and they'd assassinate, they'd chop the heads off if anybody invented anything new. But even that wisdom doesn't apply today. They wouldn't be able to survive. You can't stop the stuff that's happening today. So forget all that wise media ecology that the ancient societies had. It's like the Native Americans, eh? They went around supposedly drinking and alcoholic. They can't handle the fact they can't chop people's heads off and keep bringing in new environments. A new television show is a new environment. So that was page 8. It says, a new environment is an attack on our senses and on our sense of ourselves. Then it drops down and there's a hyphen. It numbs perception. Page 9. 34 pages, we're already at page 9. A new environment is a gorgon or a monster that can be encountered and conquered only by the bright shield of Perseus, the mirror of art. Oh, now he's getting sophisticated. A new environment is a gorgon. Remember, Perseus, he could beat the monster. If you looked at the monster directly, he would hypnotize you, eat you up. So you had to hold a mirror up or something and look at the monster in the reflection of the mirror, not look at it directly, and therefore learn how to sword play it and knife it to death through a mirror. So that's what he's saying here. A new environment is a gorgon that can be encountered and conquered only by the bright shield of Perseus, the mirror of art. You have to retrieve the past environment, turn it into an art form, which is usually considered ugly and shocking. That's the only way to confront the present environment, unless you turn the environment off. But since you can't turn it off, you're immediately altered it by it when you engage it, so you've got to use a pretty obtuse way of recognizing it. So it has an asterisk after the mirror of art, and it goes down to the bottom of the page and has the asterisk and has a quote from Wyndham Lewis. The artist is engaged in writing a detailed history of the future because he is the only person who can live in the present. Now, you have your New Agers talking about, hey, you learn this, learn that, you can know the future. You can anticipate, you can have psychic ability. This is way more sophisticated. The artist is engaged in writing a detailed history of the future because he's the only person who can live in the present, which is what Ion says. All the futures exist in your present and subsequently your past. So then McLuhan writes, after the Wyndham Lewis quote, that is why today the artist shifts from the ivory tower to the control tower. That's what I was saying in the Hype magazine, Roxy. You don't make these separate little works of art. You move to the central point of controlling the mixed corporate media and its programming. No nation, no business can navigate now without the vision of the artist. No nation, no business can navigate now without the vision of the artist. And they're not talking about Stockhausen. Maybe the closest is Zappa, because Zappa knew that he should be a manager in the nation and the business. That's why he ran for president. That's why he started a political party in 68. You must incorporate, you must be ready to take over the White House if you're a real artist. You have to be ready to do it better than Obama. They didn't teach you that in art school. They didn't teach you how to manage how to become a replacement for the Chancellor of Germany, Roxy, when you were in college. Page 10. Now there are just a couple of sentences and blank paper. Ordinary men, however, when confronted by new environments, resort to the rearview mirror. So here's McLuhan saying the rearview mirror is not exactly the shield of Perseus, the mirror of art. One is a reaction, run back to the past, like Mark Stallman and Harold Chandler, or use the new in an old medium to create something like Finnegan's Wake. That's how you use the rearview mirror. You use it as an art form, not as a knee-jerk reaction. So McLuhan says, ordinary men, however, when confronted by new environments, resort to the rearview mirror. Environments in a rearview mirror underlined. Then underneath it has in brackets, they bury their heads in the sand. They say, quote, I can't see me. They bury their heads in the sand. They say, I can't see me. So this is very didactic. So we had 10 pages. Page 11 has two words, for example. So we're going to get into a bunch of examples. So let's just reread the first 10 pages real fast to see the simple step-by-step thing that's being presented. Everybody cool with that?
Yes.
It's cool.
I apologize for sounding didactic and condescending like a teacher would be, but
It's okay.
But I am. So I'm slowly getting back to page one again, and I'll run through these simple sentences fast.
What covers your other seven?
You got to get off that speakerphone. I don't know what you're saying. Stop masturbating. Get back on the cell phone. What?
How did you know?
Well, I know this stuff gets you horny. He loves McLuhan.
This is how I reach coitus.
Yes, this is the mental porn. She loves the pattern recognition. So, all right. So, shall we wait? Shall we wait till you finish and then you get back on the phone?
Read it again.
You'll get off this time. I do it faster. I'll read it faster. Watch this.
Read it faster.
Okay. Yes. Thrust faster. Thrust. Okay. When you call me that, smile. It's not the brave man that's dangerous. It's the coward that scares me, said Owen Wister, who wrote The Virginian. This month's subject, violence. Violence is the effort to maintain and restore a weakened psyche. Violence is a quest for identity. Who am I? Violence is a norm on any frontier. Why? Because on the frontier, men have forgotten or left behind their old identities. The frontier is not a neighborhood. It is a gap, a ferment, an interface. Every new technology creates new frontiers, new environments. Asterisk. Look down. The Greek for environment is perivalo, which means to hit from all sides at once. You probably look at environments as something you see out in front of you. You don't think of it surrounding you. If you start thinking of it surrounding you, you get paranoid. Page 8. A new environment is an attack on our senses and on our sense of ourselves. Different meanings of sense there. It numbs perception. That means you can't look at it directly. You can't engage it directly. A new one, even though it's you are engaging it directly, no matter what. Satellite environment's affecting you whether you know it or not. A new environment is a gorgon that can be encountered and conquered only by the bright shield of Perseus, the mirror of art. What is art? Wyndham Lewis says, the artist is engaged in writing a detailed history of the future because he's the only person who can live in the present. That's why today the artist shifts from the ivory tower to the control tower. No nation, no business can navigate now without the vision of the artist. And basically, McLuhan considered himself the only artist that qualified for that position. Nobody else was really as artistic as he was being in the most leading-edge modern sense. Page 10. Ordinary men, however, when confronted by new environments, resort to the rearview mirror. So, if one's reading this carefully, they go, rearview mirror? Well, what? Didn't he just say the mirror of art? What's the difference? What's the difference between the mirror of art and the rearview mirror? Well, the rearview mirror is someone who buries their heads in the sand. They say, I can't see me. I don't understand me. All right. There's a bit of an echo. What? Somebody's got something on speakerphone or half a speakerphone? It's not a complete echo. It's just some kind of slight dissonance. So we're going to give some examples. Let me just see if I mute everybody if that happens. Do I get... Hey! I'm still getting it. It might be my own phone.
All participants are now unmuted.
I sound pretty clear, right? Actually, it's stopped.
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
You do.
All right. So I'm going to now give some examples of this violence and environment and interface and frontier in 1968. Page 12. The United States, like England, has too great an involvement in 19th century hardware to make it easy for us, meaning the Americans and the British, to move into the 20th century environment of electric software, software in quotes, or information technology. Therefore, our old Western frontier, based on 19th century hardware, is quite visible in the 20th century rearview mirror. Think of Bonanza on TV, the future hypnotized by the past. But the real Western frontier was quite different. For the reason why, see side probe number one on page 30. So, maybe I'll go forward to that. Okay, page 30. Side probe number one. So I'm going to reread what I said. The United States, like England, has too great an involvement in 19th century hardware. It's too successful in that past environment to make it easy for us to move into the 20th century environment of electric software or information technology. Therefore, our old Western frontier, underlined, based on 19th century hardware, is quite visible in the 20th century rearview mirror, underlined. Think of Bonanza on TV, the future hypnotized by the past. Now, we heard many times in Tony Schwartz's recordings, McLuhan talking about Bonanza. So he could say it right there in Tony's office or studio, and he's probably dictating this, so this great big executive newsletter that one's paying a lot of money for, it's just McLuhan talking off. You could hear him on the phone telling you this if you had access to him. At least so far in this simple issue number two. So we go to the real Western frontier was quite different than the one they show on TV on Bonanza. So we go to page 30. And it says, side probe number one, Napoleon's men may have marched on their stomachs, but the Wild West rode on its can. That means, you know, on its stomach, on its can, on its bum. Napoleon's men may have marched on their stomachs, but the Wild West rode on its can. Can can mean bum, but it also can mean the canned foods that were a new environment. The tin cans. The U.S. Western frontier was created by hardware, by rail, and canned goods. Early in The Virginian, that book by Owen Wister, we watched the hero as, quote, the eastbound departed slowly into that distance whence I had come. He means the train, eastbound. I stared after it as it went its way to the far shores of civilization, unquote. Then McLuhan says, however, rail alone could not have created the new image of identity that grew on the Western frontier. So he quotes, doesn't say what he's quoting here. I don't know where this is from. Quote, but portable, ready-made food plays of necessity a great part in the opening of a new country. The cowboy has now gone to worlds invisible. The wind has blown away the white ashes of his campfires, but the empty sardine box lies rusting over the face of the western earth. So the first garbage starts gathering. And then there's a statement by McLuhan, equally needed on the frontier. Quote, for instance, I learned the true value of tomatoes in this country. One fellow was buying two cans of them. His tomatoes were for drink, and thus they have refreshed me many times since. Then McLuhan says, and back on the shores of civilization, Europe had hit on the can-can. That would be a dance, you know, around 1900. And that's when the West was opening, around 1900, a few decades before that. So the can-can is the dance in Europe for a technology that's happening out west in North America. So I read that again. Napoleon's men may have marched on their stomachs, but the Wild West rode on its can. The U.S. Western frontier was created by hardware, by rail, and canned goods. Early in The Virginian, we watched the hero as, quote, the eastbound departed slowly into that distance whence I had come. I stared after it as it went its way to the far shores of civilization, unquote. However, rail alone could not have created the new image of identity that grew on the Western frontier. In other words, they needed food. Quote, but portable ready-made food plays of necessity a great part in the opening of a new country. The cowboy has now gone to worlds invisible. The wind has blown away the white ashes of his campfires, but the empty sardine box lies rusting over the face of the western earth. All those western movies you saw in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, They never showed you a canned food or, you know, an empty can by a campfire. Equally needed on the frontier. Quote, for instance, I learned the true value of tomatoes in this country, meaning out in the West. One fellow was buying two cans of them. His tomatoes were for drink, and thus they have refreshed me many times since. Meanwhile, back on the shores of civilization, Europe had hit on the can-can. Any comments? So we did page 12 and page 13.
Very interesting, this definition of environment being hit in
on all sides at once.
Yes, and also what he's saying about the gap.
Yes.
Because yes, I got this insight how every technology expands the space we are supposed to conquer.
It also implodes it.
Yes, but first there is this idea of the frontiers of we
right.
have to go further, but also in visual space we think
that's Columbus.
We are
that
yes,
begins with Columbus and then ends up with the immigrants in the West and the railway in the 19th century going to the outer visual space.
Yes, but then there was a satellite and we have to conquer space, and now there is this
yes.
frequency.
You could say, look at the media
propulsion.
As extensions of our body. You don't get rid of your eye. The eye keeps getting developed. It's like McLuhan says, centralization keeps happening, more and more centralization. That's the eye world. While decentralization, the ear world, continues also. So, yes, we go out into outer space with the rockets and that, but we have the Voyagers and the robots going to the planets and broadcasting directly back to us images of those places. So we're right there on those distant planets. So it's imploding as well as visually it's going out to some place.
Yes, for a long time, like the perception, the sense that dominated was the eye. Well, first was the ear, then the eye. Then we went back to the acoustic and now to the tactile.
Yeah, what did you say we went back to? The what? The kinesthetic?
The tactile.
No, you said
acoustic.
Yes, we didn't go back to the acoustic. We extended the eye and the ear, then the eye, then the hand. The hand is tactility. But before that, between the ear and the hand is the foot. That's the kinetic. So we did the ear, the eye, the foot, the hand. Four phases.
Mm. And now we're going to the synesthetic.
Yes. You could say central. The hand is close to the central nervous system. But yes, once you go past the hand, you go into the autonomic, synesthesiac, speed of light, speed of thought.
Non-physical.
No, I don't know if it's non-physical. It's physical. Non-physical is not... Ion speaks as non-physical. Sounds like the autonomic, but he's more than autonomic. But the autonomic is the closest to the speed of the reality that Ion describes as non-physical.
And that's the mystery landscape.
Yes. Yeah.
There is a sort of evolution in our perception too, in how the environments are hitting us.
Yeah.
Like there is a technology, and somehow some sense is activated more than the others.
And then you look at where are these changes registered in the arts. Just look at the history of painting over the last 500 years, the incredible variety of changes, like every centennial, every 100 years.
Yes,
so the changes are registered in art.
For the focal point, this...
Perspective? The near point?
No, the McLuhan book. What's the name?
Through the focal point. No,
I'm falling asleep again. I think I have to get some coffee.
You're going to leave again? Can't you take your headset?
Yes, I could.
Put your headset on. She goes, yes, I guess I could do that.
You have to be faster.
What do you mean? How do I be faster? At what? You mean fucking you? You mean thrusting here? You didn't get off?
Yes, okay. Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Just do me.
I'll stay awake.
No. Why can't you put the headset on? You got
okay.
them.
Yes, go on.
Okay, page 13. So we heard on page 12 the... This sounds so much like a seminar. I used to sit in seminars in different universities. It's like I'm the professor, and you guys are students sitting around trying to figure out what's going to be on the exam and writing notes down. I'm reading the class dogma. Think of Bonanza on TV, the future, hypnotized by the past. It's like there's a new kind of future, frontier reality happening on the synesthesia co-anesthetic level, and yet we interpret the image of the future, which is the frontier, using an old-fashioned frontier, Bonanza, the Wild West. So the future hypnotized by the past. Bonanza is close. It is a frontier, but it doesn't look like the frontier of the past. As McLuhan says, the real Western frontier was a bunch of canned goods. So page 13. But the past is not a refuge. Then he quotes James Joyce. Past times are pastimes. That's somewhere in Finnegan's Wake. He doesn't give the page number. Page 14. Our real frontier today is the interface or gap between the old mechanical hardware and the new electric software. So when you have this spaceship, the satellite environment goes around the planet, the content on the planet is mechanical hardware interfacing with new electric software. So you have these hot and cool environments, hot technology and cool technology interacting, and you're orbiting the planet from the perspective of the satellite. So when you get like that, you'll allow every culture to do its own thing. It'd be too hard to try to police it. So as you interface with the interfacing between the cool and hot technology, that's your frontier. Pretty hard to say where that is, other than in the realm of perception. Our real frontier today is the interface or gap between the old mechanical hardware and the new electric software. The old mechanical hardware created service environments of steamships, railways, postal systems, books, press, catalogs, highways, and cheap schools. Remember, McLuhan has this quote later. You never stop paying for a cheap education. The kind you get in the public schools. So you have the old mechanical hardware of steamships, railways, postal system, books, press, catalogs, highways, and cheap schools. McLuhan would say that's hardware communism. Then he says the new software or electric information services, information in quotes, the new software or electric information services of phone, light, that's like street light, radio, central heat, internal combustion, movies, and TV create multi-billion-dollar service environments, all freely accessible for the most part to everyone. Our real frontier today is the interface or gap between the old mechanical hardware and the new electric software. The old mechanical hardware created service environments of steamships, railways, postal systems, books, press, catalogs, highways, and cheap schools. That would be hardware communism. The software communism is the new software or electric information services of phone, light, radio, central heat, internal combustion, movies, and TV, which create multi-billion dollar service environments, all freely accessible for the most part to everyone. McLuhan has a story of the guy who stopped commuting to his job from the suburbs, his job downtown New York, because he could live at Grand Central and Grand Central Station and eavesdrop on all the television stuff that was there in the station and sort of avoid the commute by just living in Grand Central Station, which had all the services, all the magazine stands, all the information you wanted, if you were into that kind of information. Page 15. The big difference in our society today, therefore, is this, colon, that the poor live as much in the new software multi-billion dollar service environment of world information as the wealthy do. The big difference in our society today, therefore, is this, that the poor live as much in the new software multi-billion dollar service environment of world information as the wealthy do. It's the same with the preschool child. Before he is, quote, contained, unquote, in a 19th century school or curriculum, he has grown in a 20th century world of adult and international experience, dash, watching TV from his playpen. And this interface between TV and school, as all other interfaces, is a frontier that generates violence because it forces the child to mold the new image of himself. And McLuhan's saying this in August 68 after the student riots of the spring of 68. The interface between TV and university class. It's the same with the preschool child. Before he is contained in a 19th century school or curriculum, he's grown in a 20th century world of adult and international experience, watching TV from his playpen. And this interface between TV and school, as all other interfaces, is a frontier that generates violence because it forces the child to mold a new image of himself. See, very few lines on each page. Now we come to page 16, not much on this page. Once again, violence is the quest for identity inspired by technical innovations. Not only is it a short sentence, he's repeating what he already wrote. Or typed. It's nothing new. So then you go down to the bottom, and that statement, once again, violence is the quest for identity inspired by technical innovations. You go down to the bottom. This is one of the themes of War and Peace in the Global Village, soon to be published by Bantam Books. It probably came out a couple weeks later in August 1968. Then McLuhan says, wherever there is violence, by definition, there are people who feel that their very images of themselves have been endangered or effaced. This loss of face, in quotes, loss of face, applies to individuals as much as groups. So McLuhan is writing minimalist writing, few words on each page. Some of the patterns are repeated. It's sort of like somebody, you know, Barnett Newman making abstract art, where it's just a few squares of light, of color paint. And he repeats and repeats this thing. McLuhan is, there's a bit of a minimalist artistic aesthetic here and as a subplot in his work. He's taking very little and creating a repetitive scene with just a main point to be made. Any thoughts?
Hey, Bob?
Yes.
Can you go back to 14?
14.
Page 14?
Yes.
Because there was a mention of
hardware communism and software communism. Our real frontier today is the interface or gap between the old mechanical hardware and the new electric software. From the perspective of the satellite, you've got these 19th century countries and technologies interacting with these electric technologies, 20th century technologies that go around the hardware. So that goes around the steamships, the railways, the postal systems, the books, the press, the catalogs, the highways, and cheap schools. That's the old mechanical hardware, creating service environments of steamships, railways, etc. Then, the 20th century is the new software or electric information services. And information is in quotes. It's almost like, remember, when you're massaging people it's the particular messages aren't as important as the massage itself. The new software or electric, quote, information, unquote, services of phone, light, radio, central heat, internal combustion, movies, and TV create multi-billion-dollar service environments, all freely accessible, for the most part, to everyone. That's software communism. That do it, Bert? We did it?
Yes, but I heard somewhere, maybe it was 15, about the realms of perception.
Okay. No, that phrase is not there, but maybe this. It's the same with the preschool child. Before he is contained in a 19th century school or curriculum, he is grown in a 20th century world of adult and international experience, watching TV from his playpen. And this interface between TV and school, as all other interfaces, is a frontier that generates violence because it forces the child to mold a new image of himself. That's not it, Bert?
No, then maybe I just wrote it down, just thinking about, because when you were describing the electric software, and if you look at all of those elements, it's just like something McLuhan said about that a lot of people wouldn't buy the product, they just buy the information in the ad.
Yeah, they tell them how to think about it.
Tell them how to think about it. That's the alteration of the people's perceptions. That was where McLuhan emphasized how advertising was like the last art, or some reference to advertising, how advertising is used.
Yeah, maybe you meant this sentence. A new environment is an attack on our senses and on our sense of ourselves. It numbs perception.
Yes, probably. I just did a conclusion and made a note based on all of those, but yes.
It's an attack on our senses and on our sense of ourselves. The senses is physical. Your sense of yourselves is like your mental image. So it's an attack on your mind and your body, and it numbs tactility or perception.
So, McLuhan said something like the book, one of these the services of the book was to numb us. And then Ine said the solution would be that we go back like to this balance between the word and the written, like the Greek. But what would you say is then the solution of this numbness or hypnosis?
Well, first of all, he wrote an essay, A Plea for Time. He wanted to go back to what he saw were the values in Greece, a balance between oral and visual. And basically, he was asking for us to stop technological innovation. How else could you get time? You'd have to slow down the evolution that's changing society, technological evolution. And McLuhan developed that into a science, but it wasn't done, couldn't be done. And I don't think there is a solution other than, like Ion, is giving you the reason why you're in pain. Telling you why you're in pain. These are
reasons for
example, explaining it.
Ion also accentuates orality or verbal communication.
Yes.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean technology has to stop. Why wouldn't he think it has to stop?
But why would Innes think that?
Yes, why?
Well, his title, A Plea for Time. He's asking people, and he actually sees media having the opposite effects to McLuhan's interpretation. So the radio, McLuhan would say, decentralizes, but Innes thought it centralized. And he thought that made big bureaucracies. So we need to go back to a human smaller scale, which he called time. Centralization is space, time. So let's go back and retrieve some time, slow down the world. Let's retrieve the balance of Greece rather than being extended on the space level, radio centralization, too extremely. So McLuhan then comes along later and says, wait a minute, the computer will give me my own autonomic gauging of information with this computer technology has the speeds to study the changes going on in different countries around the world. So he found a way to modulate, as a theory, the different environments. Innes didn't have the computer. He didn't have that vision of how to have a plea for time. He almost thought, well, I'm an influential professor. I go to international conferences. If I just say this, maybe someone will do something. I doubt it. What's anybody going to do? McLuhan used to say, how can I condemn a whole people when they're involved in a whole huge environment, a new technical environment? Why would you bring in value judgments? But Innes and McLuhan were always juggling about what kind of solution is possible. McLuhan, in the end, just prayed every day, went to Mass. I think we asked McLuhan about that, or Ion on Mum, McLuhan on Maui at one point. And Ion said he went to the Mass to get out of his environment and get relief. So on page 17 it says, okay, so McLuhan often said, Roxy, that escape into understanding was his solution. The faculty of reason, the faculty of mind that the New Ages want to diminish. He thought the faculty of reason could understand the new rationalities, the new theater, and that would be more important than any technical solution.
I think for both of them, communication was central, as for you and I am.
And you already Mark Stallman. Mark Stallman was trying to make a big deal out of communication.
You already said all technologies are trying to be language
human.
Or communication.
Yes, all technologies aspire to become the condition of language. And our digital Web.2 is getting closer and closer to the intimacy of speech. Got your little box that's speaking to you all the time if you click on the right YouTubes.
Yes, and there's also this... It's like very important, the central theme of this perception of sensory, the medium as expansion of the senses.
Well, extension, because expansion implies going outer. What about extension, both inner and outer? The word extension means both directions.
So actually, like Ion sort of says, what we are trying to do through all this evolution is to talk right, to communicate right.
To be aware of the communication process beyond the simple terms that literacy creates. Comprehensive understanding of tactile interplay and communication. It's rich, a richer life, a richer sense of ourselves and our senses.
Yes, because it's like what Jesus was trying to do was to translate this, what you just said, all these not literary perception or senses.
Right.
And then if you try to do that, it seems to have no sense because there is no more linear story.
Right, it's no more linear story.
So how could you then translate this complex environment? So much information, so much input, like
Well, it's obvious McLuhan felt that Finnegan's Wake did it. Finnegan's Wake demonstrates information overload, has 10 thunders, it puts it in order. So all that you're asking, how could you do this overloaded environment? How could you make sense out of it? Well, using a book that hoiks up visual perspective, that's Finnegan's Wake. McLuhan went on about how Finney's Wake solved the problem of communication. That, and now that's what the manuscript you've got there, The Ecology of Sense, is going to spell it out in academic terms.
Mm.
McLuhan's point is going to be spelled out by Don Thiel, the manuscript that I sent Roxy.
Wow. That was never released. That's correct, Bob? That manuscript you got that was never... Wow, that's... Yeah.
But what happened... He was president of a university then, and he's writing around to various publishers, but he's pretty busy, so he can't really lobby or pull it off. In his papers I got, I see these letters that he's writing to various publishers in New York to see if they'll do it. So the book never took off, but when he retired as professor and president of a university, he had time to rewrite that book and include more prominent insights coming in the 90s. So the book did get issued in 1995 as part of a trilogy. The first part's called Beyond the Word. The second one is called James Joyce's Technopoetics. And the third one would be the book on Marshall McLuhan.
Virtual.
So, the virtual Marshall McLuhan, right, that you've read. So, the reason I think the Ecology of Sense manuscript is valuable, he lays out the basic definitions simply and straightforward that he's going to present 15 years later in these more complex books. So the background, it's almost like the manual. How to read the 90s books is in this manuscript that I happen to have a couple of extra copies were in the archives. So since Roxy's been working her butt off and is interested in Don Thiel, I thought she deserved it. I sent a copy to her.
I just got beyond the word.
I'm reading the introduction, and he says he's trying to explain why humans communicate.
Yes, it's the most basic. For most people, it'd be ridiculous to read. It's too basic. It's too abstract. Like, he's trying to explain why we communicate and how Finnegan's Wake answers that question.
Oh, man, that's...
What would you be your conclusion? Why do men communicate besides creation? Or is it all about creation?
It's all about creation. You'll see he talks about the original definition of creativity in art. He brings in Aristotle and all that stuff, and making and techne, and what is poetry. And he's in a world of excessive creation going on all around him. Is it communicating? Is it not? And he'll always stress the ambivalence that is hard to make a conclusion in this situation. And that's why Finnegan's Wake is a stronger document, because it doesn't offer a conclusion. It shows you the process. And you'll see all the other academic disciplines that are discovered the last 60 years all move towards that. We're not going to make a conclusion. We're just going to explore this, probe it. It's the big cop-out. You know, nobody can actually make a point of view until McLuhan came along and said, well, the reason we can't make a conclusion, because a conclusion would be a visual perspective, and you can't have one. So as long as we have electric media, we're going to have the ecstasy of multimedia communication.
and if there's no one here that's studying Finnegan's Wake or anything, and they're not here talking to Bob, they've missed the train.
That's right. I'm the basics. I am back to basics. You know, in the 70s, there was a reform educational movement in schools called Back to Basics. And McLuhan would always do this. He does it in the 40s, the 50s, 60s, 70s. He would have done it in the 80s. Whatever new movement shows up, he says he's already doing it, and Finnegan's Wake is how you do it. And then Don Thiel does the same thing. He shows how all the breakthroughs in different disciplines from the 50s and 60s, 70s, all are redoing the basic insights of Finnegan's Wake. And Finnegan's Wake is doing it better because it presents it in a nonlinear way. So that's what's great. You get from Thiel's books what is said in the classroom by McLuhan, you know, in the 1560s. It's like the student who stayed back and typed up all the notes that McLuhan said in class that day and organized them and then presented them as a manuscript. He did that with his PhD, just regurgitating what McLuhan said about Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, and Yeats, W.B. Yeats. Thiel's books are a great guide to the academic phenomenon that went on in the classroom with McLuhan.
Yes. Yes, his writing style is very flowing, and it gives you insight. It's just like reading him is like talking to you, Bob. But you're better because you're live, because you can get a point, and you'll get so many background references to open up more insight into items. And that's what's...
And I've been doing it longer than Don. I've been doing it for 4,000 years.
Right.
Ophidale. You know what? That's O-H. Ophidale Haybob. Hobab. That's O. O-H. O.
Oh.
That's the initials. O. Oh. When I show up, everybody goes, oh. I guess that's it. He's wrapped it up. He's put it away. Oh.
Hey, Bob, this is slight digression. Those guys that you played earlier, Harold?
Mark Stallman and Harold Channer. Did you hear that, Bert?
Yeah, I was listening I was listening in, and I'm like, because I kept trying to think, when was this tape made, Bob?
Recently? It was made last July. It's less than a year ago.
Look at that. That impression is the impression I get every time I hear somebody explaining McLuhan. It's like so incomplete and so basic, so superficial.
Yeah,
yes.
Superficial.
Yes. Yes. And these guys were ex-students of yours, and they, like, say, okay, I understand.
They were long-time friends. They only had an inkling of McLuhan, a little bit. And then I showed up in the late 90s and became friends, and we talked. And they heard nothing but all this McLuhan stuff. I showed them documents, unpublished stuff. They had a massive education from me. Mark Stallman got so inspired, he started a new salon, Nonlinear Circle. And he had made a lot of money in the AOL sale, when AOL went public. So he retired from Wall Street 93, 94, and then he got bored, so he started a salon, a cyber salon, he called it, around Silicon Alley, not Valley, West 20th Street. And it became so popular within a year or two, it was just, and this is when the dot-com boom was happening, which is all about, I'm reading about that in Pynchon's new novel. I'm finally getting around reading Pynchon's new novel, which is about this period that I'm with Mark Stallman, 1999, 2000, 2011, 2001. And it became a place where all this burgeoning people, like out in Silicon Valley in the mid-90s, trying to get jobs in the tech industry, are handing out business cards and just trying to schmooze. So he quit. He quit the salon. It just got out of control, and it wasn't an intellectual discussing thing. It wasn't like the radio he accuses Harold of being, a radio man who just likes conversation. Mark's a radio man. And his salon collapsed, and it got too successful, and then just got yuppified by our young Generation Xers running around looking for jobs in the tech industry. So he retreated for a couple of years, and he actually drifted over into the Cloaker Quadrant by a bunch of intellectuals, and he went to one of their conferences in 96 or 97 in Europe, because they'd heard about him. He was a businessman, a tech Wall Street guy, and these anarchist radicals in the Cloaker Quadrant in Denmark wanted a businessman, potential CIA guy. So Mark Stallman fit the bill. So he meets all these guys, and then a year later, in 98, he hears me. He goes to the McLuhan conference. He hears me talk. He realizes I'm the most extraordinary McLuhanite there. So he comes up to me after, and he says, I need to talk to you. So we met after the conference, after that day, and we get talking, he and his girlfriend, and at some point I bring up LaRouche. He doesn't say anything, but I start mentioning LaRouche and McLuhan and all the stuff, and then either later that night or the next day, he calls me up and he says, "That was extraordinary. You brought up LaRouche. No one knows LaRouche, Bob. Nobody knows about him." I said, "You know LaRouche?" He says, "Yes, I used to be his bodyguard." And that triggered off a whole new fucking thing. And so he knew I was different. So then we would get together through April, May, June. I'd bring down unpublished articles, especially the conspiracy stuff. He loved that because he was a LaRouche. He was into the secret society stuff McLuhan was talking about. Nobody knew back then McLuhan had written about it. So then he met George Soros' secretary. Remember, he mentions George Soros? Well, the secretary bumps into her someplace, and she's living in New York for a while, so she craves intellectual contact, so he comes back to me. He said, "Bob, let's start a salon. You know, we can get the George Soros people in here." And he said, "I've wanted to start a salon. I didn't like the way the previous one went, but I had nothing to work with. But you've got all this new information. We can build a salon around you." So that's what we did. We started the Nonlinear Circle, and the first meeting was on my father's birthday, June 4th, 1998, the dates of the two memos of Prince Charles. So we did it for 2 years. I think the last seminar was in February, March 2000, and it featured Carolyn. She gave the last seminar, or featured speaker. So all these heavies, I met all these heavies in the dot-com industry would come to the salon, because Mark had a reputation for having an interesting salon. They all knew him from his Wall Street world, so I met everybody in the dot-com world, which as soon as I got on TV on April 14th, 2000, it collapsed. As soon as I got on TV, the whole fucking thing fell apart, and they all were poor again.
So what I'm getting from this is like the control of the communication and the information through technology is what gives you the power to create the environment.
Yes. That's why there
is this concept of the Illuminati, of someone controlling all of us.
Creating culture. You'll see in the electric light book that you want to read, you'll go to the salon and read the blue book, you'll see an essay in 1954 about Catholic humanism in the letters, modern letters. There's a section there where McLuhan says near the end that the modern managers of society have learned how you make culture. And that's what Tetra Management does. It knows that the medium is the message, that media creates new cultures, older media create culture. The key is communication, which Harold Channer couldn't see. Harold Channer had abstract concepts of the universe and of consciousness and that it was evolving to some state, but he would deny it was any new age vision. He wasn't sure what he meant. It was really based on Bucky Fuller, which is based on technology, but he didn't like Mark emphasizing technology so much. So you had two McLuhanites arguing over McLuhan. That's what that thing was. And they learned the argument from me.
Yes, and I understand also what you were telling me in the Pergamon Museum, in the Babylon,
yes,
the Wall of Babylon.
Right.
The Ishtar.
The what? Did you knock it? Oh, she knocked herself off. Maybe her phone went dead. Yeah, I'm watching the template, and it just blipped out.
Yeah, it sounds
now
like...
Now there's even less of us. There's Eliza and Cherie, who just sleep through this thing, and Sean in England, she's probably sleeping. So it's just you and me, Bert, and Madeline. I don't know what Madeline's probably sleeping, too.
Okay, Bob, I'll
listen
to you.
I knew Madeline would speak up. And Roxy's back. So what, did you not drop your phone, Roxy?
No, sorry.
Did you drop it?
My Skype. No, my Skype. Speak
goes off after 4 hours.
Yes, I don't know how long it takes, but it goes.
Yeah, it'll go off. There's something.
Yeah, but you were making fun in front of this gate. How could people be numb by that? But at the time, that was
yes. Why it was so puny? It was one of the wonders of the world, and it was so puny compared to our expanded, intensified
century. A wall with mosaic.
A couple of carvings.
Yes, you know, it was a new technology, like, and people were so amazed by that.
Yeah, visual space. It was the beginning of visual space. I mean, these are people who had ESP, could see through matter, and all of a sudden somebody created something where you couldn't see through it. What the fuck is that?
Yes, but the elite had the technology of the alphabet of writing, and they were known by this writing on the wall.
Yeah. It's like McLuhan when someone said, "We're studying your book, The Medium is Massage," and he says, "That's not a book. That's just a smattering of quotations." Well, it's the same as this is not a eighth wonder of the world. Just a smattering of cement blocks, brick. Just a smattering, a lousy collage of brick and carving.
Yes, but all technologies are that actually. Once
yes.
you understand. It's like, well,
yep.
so easy.
Is that all there is?
Yeah.
What? The internet? Is that all there is? I've been living with it for 20 years. Tiny. Now, ION.
Yes.
I defy anybody to go with ION. Is that all there is? Just ION and mana and,
no, but
and RNA drops and hologram mutation?
That's all? What's next?
Yeah.
The difference is that they have these clay tablets, and now we have this big data. It's like a lot of information data there.
We have an iPhone tablet, you know, the tablet that everybody has, that opens up to millions of worlds. It's like a crystal ball. You know, you look in the ball, and there's all this imagery. That's what people are doing with their clay tablet, now called an, what are they called? iTablet? iPad.
iPad.
Yeah.
And if it's not Apple, then it's tablet, like Samsung tablet.
Right. Well, here on page 17, he has, in a world of very rapid technological change, the sense of identity is, then he goes down a line, not, and drops down another line, only, drops down, threatened. So the sense of identity is not only threatened, comma, but, drops down, but, and then the word shattered is spelled down, S-H-A-T-T-E-R-E-D. You know, it's linear. Takes like 9 spaces to spell out shattered. And then it says over and another line, over again. So in a world of very rapid technological change, the sense of identity, and it starts to go down, is not only threatened, but shattered and falls to the bottom over and over again. That's how it's laid out. So I wanted to say, so Mark Stallman and I, we start the nonlinear circle on June 4th. There's a big conference of the Silicon Alley magazine in the middle of July in downtown New York, with all the digirati you guys eventually hear about, like Douglas Rushkoff, they're all there. So what did we do? Me and Mark and a guy named Lance Rose. Now, Lance was a lawyer who in the 80s built the ATMs. He would go around and be the legal advisor to the companies that built the ATM so that it could be implemented. He was the legal expert. You probably could find books by Lance Rose. And he became a friend of Mark's, and then I met him, and he was part of our nonlinear circle. And he was a guy in his 40s, maybe, 40s, 50s, and he intellectually curious about arts and things. He bought albums all the time or CDs, but he'd never heard of McLuhan. And so being a a naturally, you know, healthy, curious intellectual. He's there, how the fuck did I miss this? This fucking guy is incredible. So he became a real McLuhan fanatic. So we put on a little performance. Have you ever seen the Bob Dylan, when he does the footage in the mid-60s, Subterranean Homesick Blues, where he's holding these placards with the lyrics and he's letting them fall to the ground, and Allen Ginsberg is in the background, like dressed like a rabbi. Have you ever seen that early video or film that accompanied Subterranean Homesick Blues? Well, you've seen it?
No.
Are you going, what are you saying?
No.
Oh, no. Okay, you can Google it. It's real easy. You can Google it right now and see Subterranean Homesick Blues. Well, what we did, we put on the music, and Mark stood at the podium haranguing the audience as if he's lecturing him. I'm standing there with my in my short pants, dropping placards with McLuhanism and tetrads on them, right? And Lance Rose is sitting in a chair with a pipe, being a visually biased guy, staring at me and Mark, you know, with a perspective of a guy smoking a pipe trying to figure out what me and Mark were doing. So we did that, and we did this performance imitating Subterranean Homesick Blues, and a few people liked it. Doug Reschkoff did not like it. Anyways, Mark goes on to, he returns to Wall Street in the early 2000s to be an advisor, and that only lasts a few years because Wall Street collapses again. Lance Rose goes nuts and starts doing whores and crack cocaine, and he's got two daughters, but he is divorced, or something happened. No, his wife died, that's right. So he freaked out when his wife died within around that time, late 90s, so he became lost, and eventually died by 2007. And I left town. I got the fuck out of there. Yeah, that was the end of our salon. Mark Stallman's back there. The only guy he has to talk to from the mental cargo cult of Bob is Harold Channer. And Harold Channer ain't going to agree with him. That's all he's got left. Lance Rose is dead and Bob's gone to paradise. Subterranean Homesick Blues. What?
I saw the video. He has these words written on paper and he's just throwing them.
Dropping them into the ground. That's what I did with all this McLuhan stuff. I'm standing there with a T-shirt and short pants among all these executives. Dropping obscure McLuhan aphorisms. But Subterranean Homesick Blues, that's Harold and Mark. They're marginalized in New York City's intellectual world. Lance went to hell, died, and Bob went to another kind of subterranean area and transcended the blues.
You achieved, like Bob Dylan writes on his paper, suck sense.
Yes, that's right. Suck, S-U-C-K. Hyphen C-E-S-S, success.
So, success.
And I put out an article in 92, an interview down in Costa Rica called Entertainment Sucks. So, that's, I knew the vacuum principle. Yeah, entertainment, success. Anyways, so Bert, you were digging the dialogue. If you listen to that, it's two guys left over from Bob who visited them and left, and they're arguing over, and they're talking about McLuhan, and everything they say about McLuhan, they learned from me. Mark never knew who John Culkin was. He learned, John Culkin's the guy on Ed site, you know, the guy there with the McLuhan audios, the Tony Schwartz is McLuhan with the priest, John Culkin. That's who Mark quotes in the dialogue.
I found Mark hilarious. He kept trying to always jab Harold with, "You're a radio guy. You're a radio guy."
Yeah. He kept pointing at him. This is what he used to. Bob used to say that. Well, he's a radio man. McLuhan used to say it. I remember talking to McLuhan's wife, Corinne. She said, "Well, he's a radio man." These are all old McLuhan words. Here's Irish Mark. It's an after image. It's after the end of the world. He's there using McLuhan's. pocket. And Harold said, what the fuck are you talking about? What do you mean a radio? I'm no radio man. This is TV. It's actually hilarious if you know the whole story behind it. I couldn't believe it. I just earlier today said, I wonder what Harold Channer's doing. I like to go check my interview to see how many views it has. So, but once a year ago, look, I go and look, and one of them is up to 9,000 views. And so then I just stumbled, oh, there's Mark and Harold. What are they doing? So I listened to it, and I said, oh, this is priceless. This would be awesome to play this.
I got to go back and listen to your interview with him. I remember watching maybe 15 minutes, but I got to go back and listen to the whole thing just to get a kick.
It's the same argument. It's the same argument Mark's having, and I'm better at it. I get a lot more ammunition than Mark. Mark just does conventional shit. I actually sound science fictionally futuristic in what I say to Harold. He doesn't even have a clue what I'm talking about.
That was just like when did you have him on Bob Fest? I mean, just within the last few years, you talked.
We called him up one night. I don't know if it was in Bob Fest, but we called him up one night. Remember? We talked to him.
Yeah.
But I have the impression you were talking 40 years and nobody really got what you were saying.
Yes.
That's an understatement.
Just listen to Walter Boltwood. He'll tell you that too. He said that as well.
Yeah, he said, there's only two people who ever understand you, Bob, and you haven't met him yet. Even Walter gave up. He didn't include himself.
Yeah.
I said everybody disappeared. I lived as if everybody disappeared. Me and Carol were the first to reappear, and I then created non-physical.
Yes.
I evoked the snake. Like Carol and I are in the Garden of Eden, and we retrieved the serpent at Zion.
Yes, it's the oddity. It's like this hero is trying to go back home, like
yes.
me, and he just encounters monsters.
That's right. Mark and Channer were monsters in their own way.
Yeah, like you were talking about the gargoyles.
Yeah, gargoyle cults.
No, the gargoyles.
The gargoyles, the Gorgon, the Gorgon. Yes.
Gorgon, yeah, the Gorgon.
But like Harold, we called him up. He's so ridiculous. Remember, they're being sued. He'd be kicked out of there. And all of a sudden, I'm trying to say, hey, you might want to look at this Ion stuff. He could not hear it.
Would not hear it.
Yeah. And now Mark Stallman, he's on one of the early tailgates, and he comes in. He has one of the early sessions with, because we used to do sessions with the Evergreens. He was quite impressed with that. So now he was interested in Bob's newest toy. So he had a session. He seemed to be impressed. But after, his girlfriend told him, no, that's bullshit. So he decided it was bullshit. But he came into an early tailgate, and you can hear him. And he told me later, I asked a question, and Ion ignored me. Like, he had such a big ego about himself, he was shocked that Ion didn't answer his question. He thought he should be acknowledged right away. So their own vanities get in the way here of what's happening. So Mark started coming on my Facebook page and blasting stupid stuff, so I banned him from my Facebook page.
So he's going to go in a tailspin like...
Alan Cabal, he's
going to go on a tailspin like Alan Cabal then.
Oh, we asked Ion here. Did you hear that? We asked Ion, did Cabal get our emails? He said, yes, he did. And he didn't know. What was he going to do? Just send a smiley back at you, Bob?
He should at least do that.
Yeah, he should acknowledge him. He's the kind of guy who will observe this and take his time to figure out what's going on here. You know, he'll keep studying it. But the, so Mark is banned from the Facebook. He comes on and just says bullshit. He says, Bob's a Gnostic, Ion's a Gnostic, Ion's bullshit, Ion's not even as good as the Evergreens. Just says crap. So we don't need that. And he'll never know that I'm doing this whole discussion of him because he doesn't listen to the show. He won't know. It'll come back to him at some point. I'll put this interview on Facebook, on my Facebook, and it'll spread all over the place. And he and Harold will start getting weird emails. You guys are fucking stupid. What's wrong with you fuckers, you know? Okay, well, that was a long interruption. Sorry, Ed, for the this is the interruption of the do line. So, we're on page 18. We're over halfway through. So, we said, in a world of very rapid technological change, the sense of identity is not only threatened, but shattered over and over again. Shattered is spelled out like a ladder, you know, going down. This is why, page 18, this is why what has been called slum clearance, in quotes, causes as much violence as current education. The new inclusive identity image of the slum dweller, the new inclusive identity is hyphenated, the new inclusive identity image of the slum dweller, as much as the identity image of the adolescent, is utterly distorted when confronted by the 19th century hardware that is offered to him as an improved and salubrious environment of home or school. So the oral kid in the ghetto goes through distortion when they have to go to a visually biased hardware school. Then the new slum clearance buildings, slum clearance in quotes, the new slum clearance buildings are 19th century containers without neighborhoods. So the new buildings they put in take away the black community. The ghetto, they're made into visual space blocks. They are designed by visually oriented bureaucrats with an antiseptic genius for classification and packaging. These people are motivated somnambulists, frightened by the new software electric environment. Had Moses been a committee, the children of Israel would still be in the original wilderness. It says, see side probe number 2, page 31. So, we'll go to page 31. Side probe number 2. The whole slum clearance situation, including the resulting violence, has a parallel in, quote, Algeria Unveiled, unquote, as told by France Fanon in, quote, Studies in a Dying Colonialism. McLuhan says, it was hoped to endow the Algerian woman with a warlike sense of identity by simply popping them into Western dress, just as we try to endow the slum dweller with a literate and visually oriented psyche by popping him into a hygienic box or apartment. Franz Fanon states, quote, one must have heard the confessions of Algerian women or have analyzed the dream content of certain recently unveiled women to appreciate the importance of the veil for the body of the woman. Without the veil, she has an impression of her body being cut up into bits, put adrift. The limbs seem to lengthen indefinitely. When the Algerian woman has to cross a street, for a long time she commits errors of judgment as to the exact distance to be negotiated. The unveiled body seems to escape, to dissolve. She has an impression of being improperly dressed, even of being naked. She experiences a sense of incompleteness with great intensity. She has the anxious feeling that something is unfinished, and along with this a frightful sensation of disintegrating. The absence of the veil distorts the Algerian woman's corporal pattern. She quickly has to invent new dimensions for her body, new means of muscular control. She has to create for herself an attitude of unveiled woman outside. That's hyphenated, unveiled hyphen woman hyphen outside. She has to create for herself an attitude of unveiled woman outside. She must overcome all timidity, all awkwardness, for she must pass for a European. And at the same time, be careful not to overdo it, not to attract notice to herself. The Algerian woman who walks stark naked into the European city relearns her body, reestablishes it in a totally revolutionary fashion. This new dialectic of the body and of the world is primary in the case of the revolutionary woman. Unquote. So here's this culture been wearing this veil for like hundreds of years, And then technology starts to change the global village, so these women have the shock of their veil taken off. And it's like going on a drug. You get totally disoriented, showing that they've been, the veil has massaged them into certain sensory positions for hundreds of years. So with that in mind, we go back and reread page 18. Slum clearance. That's, you've seen those images of the destroying of the buildings they built. So, okay, they wipe out the ghetto. They build some block apartment building. They last for 15 years, and then they bomb them. You ever seen that? The whole building collapses?
Yes, yes.
That footage? So this is the phase before when they're getting rid of the ghettos and then building these blocks that later get destroyed. Because, you know, 15 years later, society can't remember why they made these slum clearance buildings because the sensory perceptions have changed so much. So McLuhan says, this is why what has been called slum clearance causes, This is why what has been called slum clearance causes as much violence as current education. The new inclusive identity image of the slum dweller, as much as the identity image of the adolescents. So the kids in the slums are made even more tribal and unified through transistor radios and TV, and they're even more extremely upset when they adopt the old clothing of the 19th century school. Same as the same effect as taking the veil off the Algerian woman. You take the kid out of the ghetto, he gets disoriented. So McLuhan says, the new inclusive identity image of the slum dweller, as much as the identity image of the adolescent, is utterly distorted when confronted by the 19th century hardware that is offered to him as an improved and salubrious environment of home or school. The new slum clearance buildings are 19th century containers without neighborhoods. They are designed by visually oriented bureaucrats with an antiseptic genius for classification and packaging. These people are motivated somnambulists, affrighted by the new software electric environment. Had Moses been a committee, the children of Israel would still be in the original wilderness.